an exciting, gripping, interesting, satisfying, and lyrically written adventure tale with enough chickadees to satisfy me. How can all of that be true of a single book? Somehow, Caroline Van Hemert managed the impossible with her book, The Sun is a Compass, a 4,000-mile journey into the Alaskan wilds, published by Little Brown Spark on March 19th. I have author Caroline Van Hemert by phone here at the KUMD studio in Duluth to tell us about her amazing adventure. Caroline, I am thrilled to be talking to you.
Well, Laura, it's such an honor. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, you've been one of my heroes for years because of your chickadee work, so we'll get back to that.
Great.
Can I ask you a favor? Can you start by reading two paragraphs from your prologue, starting at the bottom of page 3?
It's the 5th of August, 2012. Over the last 139 days, we have traversed nearly 3,000 miles, most recently through places so lightly traveled, our topographic maps have little to say about them. Only the highest peaks are labeled, and then solely by elevation. The Brooks Range is the northernmost major mountain range on Earth and has retained its integrity in ways that few places have. Many of the creeks and valleys are nameless, their curves and riffles left unexplored. There are no soft edges here, no boardwalks or trails or park rangers. It's wild, empty, and gritty. We're here because we're attempting to travel entirely under our own power from the Pacific Northwest to a remote corner of the Alaskan Arctic. We're here because we need wilderness like we need water or air, like we need each other. For me, this trip is also a journey back to trees and bird song, to lichen and hoofprints. Before leaving, I had lost my way on the path that carried me from biology to natural wonder. I had forgotten what it meant, not only in my mind, but in my heart, to be a scientist.
That is so splendid.
Well, thank you.
Tell us about your trip. What exactly, where did you start, where did you end up, and how did you travel?
Sure. So we started in Bellingham, Washington, kind of the northwestern corner of Washington State, and took rowboats up the Inside Passage to a remote cabin we had built several years before in southeast Alaska near Haines. And then from there, we left our rowboats and swapped those out for skis and pack rafts. And for any listeners who aren't familiar with pack rafts, they're these amazing little rubber rafts that you can roll up and put in your backpack, and they're very lightweight and sort of allow you to be amphibious, which can be really handy in certain places in Alaska and the north in general. We took our pack rafts with our skis strapped on across the water to cross the Coast Mountain Range by skis, and then got into the headwaters of the Yukon River, where we picked up a canoe and canoed to Dawson City, and then continued there by pack raft and foot east into the Wind River drainage and up into the Mackenzie River drainage, and eventually made our way to the Arctic coast. And from the Arctic coast, we headed west to the Alaska border, hiking and pack rafting as we went until we hit a community called Kaktovik, which is essentially the kind of gateway to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And we crossed through the refuge and got into the Brooks Range Mountains and then traversed west across the Brooks Range until we hit the headwaters of the Noatak River, this amazing river that flows kind of northwest and comes out into the Chukchi Sea. And eventually we went to Kotzebue, and the Noatak River was the other section that we canoed, and then reaching Kotzebue just before freeze up in September.
How did you plan out your transportation for the trip? The decisions to use canoe, when to use raft?
Yeah, it was a combination of trying to come up with the best way to travel through, you know, a given area, but then also minimizing the number of transitions. So we were relying on the Postal Service for most of our food resupplies and any gear swaps that we needed to do, with just a couple of exceptions. My parents did a kind of a gear pickup for us in Dawson when we needed to get rid of our skis and get more of our backpacking hiking equipment. And then, like I mentioned, we stopped at the cabin to do another gear swap. And then we had one airdrop in the Western Brooks Range that almost turned disastrous. But in general, yeah, we tried to choose modes of transport that worked best for that particular, you know, landscape or body of water without requiring us to do crazy logistical things to get boats from one place to another. Specifically, we chose the rowboats for coming up the Inside Passage. because we really wanted to be able to use our entire bodies, not just our upper bodies, because we were going to be transitioning to skiing and hiking. And we knew that if we were sitting in kayaks for 6 or 8 weeks with our legs just kind of atrophying, it might be a really difficult transition. So that was one of the motivations for rowing. We were also interested in how stable they would be because we knew it would be a pretty stormy spring period. And with they're pretty beamy boats, and they have 10-foot long oars. So you have essentially these large outriggers. So they ended up being very stable in even pretty big seas. The big disadvantage we discovered when we were planning was the fact that expedition style rowboats are just not commercially available. And so we had already mentally committed to the idea of rowing at that point, and the only thing that we had come up with was the option of Pat building the boats. Fortunately, he is a builder by training, so but it wasn't a job that he needed to take on at that moment, but he did, and so the boats were, yeah, pretty amazing assets to have on the trip, but it came at a bit of a time cost. And so we took the rowboats, and then for the pack raft, that was a pretty obvious decision because it allows us to cross over so many different drainages and cover large swaths of Alaska that wouldn't otherwise be possible if we were just hiking or just boating. And then the canoeing, those were sections where we sort of had the luxury of being able to get a boat, you know, available to us. So between Whitehorse and Dawson City, it's a pretty popular canoeing route. And so there was already a rental company in place that we could easily pick up a boat and drop it off. And it was logistically straightforward. So that was nice. And it was luxury to have all that space rather than being in our little pack raft. And the same thing for the Noatak River. A canoe was very preferable to the pack rafts, and we were able to get an airdrop there with a canoe in it.
What kind of dangers did you plan for?
Well, bears were certainly on our minds, especially in the Arctic coast, where the sort of barren ground, grizzlies tend to be in a much more hungry country. So there's not nearly as much for them to eat as there is in places like, you know, Southeast Alaska, where there's really abundant fish resources, and bears seem to be a bit more mellow, I guess, in terms of personal space and interactions with humans. And so we were a bit concerned about bears on the Arctic coast, both grizzlies and potentially polar bears. So we knew that, you know, we had to be aware of that potential danger. And then I think just weather is a huge one. So when we were boating, any storms were of concern. Crossing the coast mountains by skis, we were particularly concerned about avalanche conditions and then just typical mountain hazards, crevasses, and coming on and off ice falls where there's a potential for serious slips or falls, things like that.
I'd love to hear your take on how people should balance taking precautions and spending a lot of time planning ahead of time without growing excessively fearful.
Yeah, that's a really important part, I think, of taking on trips in the wilderness. And it is easy to be intimidated by all the things that we don't know, so much so that it can be paralyzing. But I think, you know, information gathering, that's certainly one of my go-to mechanisms for trying to understand something or prepare for it. Is, you know, I'm a scientist by training, so my natural inclination is to gather information, gather data. But there's only so much of that you can do in advance, especially for places that, you know, may not have trip reports or any records of anyone, you know, doing that same route. And so I think the information gathering happens both before we left, and then a really key resource along the way was that of local knowledge. So we tried every time we, you know, met people or came through communities to talk to people who had spent a lot of time in that particular, you know, neck of the woods. And so that gave us great insights about, you know, the right choices to make as far as route and potential hazards that maybe we weren't aware of. But all that said, there's, you know, there's no great way to eliminate all sources of danger or risk. And I think in the wilderness, one thing that is easy to point to is, oh, there's, you know, there's bears or there's this uncertain weather and you don't know where you're going and all these terrible things could happen. Whereas in our day-to-day lives, you know, in the city or suburban setting or even a rural setting, we accept a certain level of risk associated with our normal activities, driving, you know, walking down the sidewalk, just life. Life is kind of inherently dangerous. And I guess part of it is trying to acknowledge that that exists no matter where you are. It's just a lot more apparent, I think, when you're in the wilderness and, you know, looking around and seeing kind of the natural cycles of life and death. It's hard not to recognize your own mortality in the context, I guess, of the wilderness. But yeah, I try really hard not to let the fear of the unknown turn me off from trying new things, and usually well worth the reward. Of course, we want to do that within the best of our abilities to be safe at the same time.
You started this trip minutes after completing your PhD work, and Pat had been really busy completing a house and making the rowboats, so you didn't have time to get into physical training the way people always recommend that one does. Do you regret not being able to take that time, or did you just get into the flow of it as the trip started?
Yeah, I think one luxury of a trip of this length, where you're going for a long time and doing the same activity for an extended period, is that you sort of have the opportunity to train as you go.
Yeah.
It wasn't ideal, of course. It would have been nice if we were in perfect rowing shape and had all that good muscle memory and all the calluses already built up. But that wasn't the biggest problem in terms of getting ready to go. I think that the bigger challenges were just carving out the time to make it happen, all the logistics involved and making sure our resupply packages were going the right place at the right time, because everything had to be done before we left, essentially. And so I think that, yeah, the getting in shape would probably be a lot more critical if a person was to go on a, you know, 3 or 5 day trip where they really needed their bodies and all of their systems to be in perfect working order prior to leaving, because that was the only time that they had. I mean, there certainly are, you know, things to be aware of too. In terms of training, I don't recommend that you go and try something that you've never done, you know, for 6 months without a little bit of preparation or training. And the context, of course, has a lot of impact too on how important it is. So if we were trying to do a technical rock climb, then I think the training is absolutely critical. If you're, you know, going hiking or rowing, then perhaps you can get away with a bit more of learn as you go. We also had a lot of experience on the water, so that was a new element to us. So we were used to the marine environment and currents and tides and potential storms and things like that. So all of that knowledge certainly went into it. It's just the physical act of getting in rowing shape that took a bit longer to get comfortable with.
I was struck many times in reading it how carefully you had to pack things, because you were carrying things on your back. Sometimes everything was on your backs. But then I noticed that you were reading books. And so how many books did you lug, and how many did you just jettison them as you finished them? And I found that intriguing.
Yeah, so the books were definitely a luxury item. And in some parts of the trip, I could absolutely get away with it because, for example, the rowboat's weight was not a limiting factor. We could take as much as we wanted, and it didn't really have a huge impact on our ability to move efficiently. So certainly on the Inside Passage, I did a lot of reading. And then different sections of the hiking and skiing portions, I was able to take a book along, but I would just send them strategically, you know, in our post office boxes that we had shipped to ourselves. That was our main resupply method. So I would, you know, put one in when I thought I could get away with carrying a bit of extra weight. And then, yeah, we would just leave them behind as we went, which I always have a hard time doing because I'm such a book lover. But it was well worth having a bit of reading material along the way, and tried to be strategic so that when we were in the Arctic, you know, I was reading about the Arctic, or in, you know, the Western Brooks Range, parts of the Gates of the Arctic were really wonderful to read about there, and things like that. So yeah, I didn't do as much reading as I would have loved, but I did get to sneak in some books here or there.
How about journaling? How much did you do every day?
Yeah, I tried to journal most days. Sometimes I would skip a day or two if we had a really intense burst. We were generally traveling very long days, like 12 or 14 hour days. And then for all of our time in the Arctic, we were cooking over a fire, which, you know, was okay up there. We were able to keep it very low impact. I know that some parts of North America, that would not be okay because fire hazard is such a big deal. But so that all took time, and then setting up camp and breaking down camp and things like that. So there wasn't that much time in the day necessarily. So as far as the journaling one, I did try to do it most days. I actually carried with me a little tiny keyboard that could be rolled up, and I was able to type a lot of notes. I'd had a write-in-the-rain notebook as well, but I can type a lot faster than I can write these days. And so that allowed me to kind of record what I was seeing. I tried to keep notes on birds and wildlife sightings on a near daily basis, and then just wrote a lot down about, you know, what we had experienced in particular places and observations and things that seem like you'll never forget them in the moment, but much later, it's harder to recall.
You were using some small solar rechargers for your things that needed recharging?
Exactly, yeah. So we carried with us a little tiny foldable solar panel that allowed us to keep up charge on the cell phone we were using, just essentially for record keeping. We weren't, now there's so much amazing technology in terms of all of the electronic maps and aerial imagery and things like that. And we had some of that, but there's even more now available. So we actually had a GPS as well, a separate GPS unit, and our camera battery. So there were a few things that we were able to charge with the solar panel. And then when we came through communities, we had all of the adapters for actually plugging into a wall socket and charging up in between traveling. So we were carrying all those cords, which we didn't obviously need in the wilderness, but came in really handy when we wanted to recharge everything along the way.
You're an ornithologist. Do you also consider yourself a birder?
You know, I've thought about that a lot over the years. I think so, because I would like to think of the term birder as being inclusive rather than exclusive, in part because I think the more that we all associate ourselves with birds in our lives, the better chance birds have of, you know, long-term conservation, because I think the science is important, but ultimately it's the public as a whole who sort of decides our outcome for habitat and all of the things that birds need to persist for hopefully a very long time. But yeah, I am a birder in the sense that I love to look at birds. I keep a working list of what I'm seeing, usually more in a regional sense, so less of a sort of life list and more of these are all the birds I've seen in this area or on this trip. And so I had a working list from our bigger trip as well that's described in the book, and really enjoyed seeing new species and, you know, keeping track of where I saw individual species along the way. That said, I'm not a hardcore birder in the sense that I will rarely take a trip just to go and see birds, but I tend to be more generalist, so I'll go out to places where birds also happen to really like to live and get the chance to have a bit of an adventure as well as seeing a lot of really cool birds along the way. I also get to do a lot of sort of birding as part of my work. So I've done a lot of bird surveys over the years in some really amazing places, mostly in Alaska, and that's been a real treat and a gift.
On this trip, how many species of chickadees did you see?
I saw black-capped chickadee, chestnut-backed chickadee, boreal chickadee, and gray-headed chickadee. So four species in total.
No mountain?
No mountains. We weren't quite in the right area. So we were coastal for most of British Columbia. So yeah, as far as their northern range, we were kind of outside of that.
But gray-headed, and your first experience that you wrote about with the gray-headed chickadees was wonderful.
Oh, well, thank you. That was an amazing kind of gift after a fairly frightening and difficult experience in terms of swimming across this river that was a lot bigger and swifter than we had anticipated. And yeah, it was a pretty special thing to see a species that I don't know that I'll ever see again in North America.
And it wasn't just a gray-headed chickadee. You came upon a family.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I've been a former wildlife rehabber, and so I was especially moved by some of your experiences with the baby rough-legged hawk that Pat took the picture of.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we can just say briefly what happened there. So we had gotten to Herschel Island, which is way up on in a little island in the Arctic Ocean on the Canadian side of the border. And we had gotten to Herschel Island where we were getting a resupply that was flown in by a park ranger. And we had a day to kind of rest and recoup and gather all of our supplies and pack up again before leaving. And so we decided to take a little hike around the island, which is in this amazing location. And as we were coming around, there's these mud bluffs that are a pretty characteristic feature along a lot of that Arctic coastline and also on Herschel Island. And there are these steep mud bluffs that are kind of underlain with permafrost. And, you know, I think naturally they erode over time, and that process has sped up quite a bit because of the warmer temperatures in the Arctic now, and also increased storm surge because there's less sea ice protecting a lot of that coast. So anyway, we had seen along the way a lot of other places where gyrfalcons and rough-legged hawks were nesting up on these cliffs, and it's a pretty cool thing because when you come from the tundra, you can actually kind of see the nest, you know, from above, or at least in line with them. And then walking down along the coastline, look up and see, you know, lots and lots of raptors, which was a really cool feature of that coast. But on Herschel Island, we were hiking along the edge of the water at the base of one of these kind of collapsing mud bluffs and came across two downy, rough-legged hawk chicks, and their nest had slid down from far up above, kind of right just above the water line. And when we encountered them, they were alive, but they were probably, you know, not in great shape for surviving into the future because of where their nest location ended up. And we didn't see their parents around anywhere. there was a headless lemming lying nearby that, you know, indicated that they had been provisioned there at some point, but whether that was going to continue, I don't know.
But there was at least hope. The one still looked pretty sturdy.
Yeah, yeah. I actually just assumed that they were both dead when we came upon them because they weren't moving and, you know, we saw them in this really unlikely place and then came up closer and saw them looking back at me. And yeah, it was a pretty moving experience for me as well, just in knowing these chicks are vulnerable and beautiful little birds that hopefully will survive. But without seeing their parents, it's hard to know what their outcome would be.
But I was grateful that you saw that headless lemming.
Absolutely. Yeah, there was hope for sure.
And you had a really exciting and scary encounter with baby brants, which are little saltwater geese that look a little bit like our Canada geese. Can you tell us about coming upon the brant family and what happened?
Sure. So we were hiking again along that narrow band between the ocean and those steep mud bluffs. And so sometimes we would have to go up above and walk on the bluffs, but in certain areas we could walk along the beach more easily. And we were doing that and we were, you know, making pretty good time. It was a pretty stormy day. It wasn't too long before that Pat had actually capsized his raft in the Arctic Ocean. And so we were happy to be on land. And we came up, we noticed this family of brant geese. So there were, you know, the two adults and then three young, and they were running down the beach in front of us. And obviously the little ones were I don't know exactly how old they were, but, you know, pretty fresh out of the nest and pretty gangly and awkward and doing their best to keep up with their parents. But as we were walking, they were feeling pressure from us to keep running ahead. And so we kind of sat down and tried to decide what we should do because we didn't want to push them, but we also needed to somehow get around them. It wasn't a place where we could camp that night, and the bluffs there were far too steep for us to be able to climb up. And so we debated our options, and we thought, well, if we can make a path, maybe that'll be the safest for them and allow us to get, you know, away from them and let them do what they need to do. So we started to walk, and as we did, we realized that that wasn't going to work because one of the chicks and its parents had run ahead, and the other two were already kind of in the surf and swirling around. They washed up again, and then I realized that our only option was going to be to try to grab them and reunite them with their parents, because at that point, the rest of the family was long gone. They weren't going to wait to see what happened to the other goslings. So Pat and I were easily able to corner them, grab them, kind of tuck their heads under their wings and run with them in our jackets and try to catch up with the rest of the family. And at that point, we realized that the parents and the older or the larger sibling had already gone into the water. And so at that point, it seemed like maybe the best option was to reunite them with the rest of the family. So we made our best guess and tossed them into the water and watched them as they got tumbled by the waves, but eventually made it past that surf zone. And the parents had taken off and then flew back around to rejoin their young, which was a big relief. And so we got ourselves out of there and hopefully stopped bothering them as quickly as we could and hoped for the best that they were able to stay together and get back on land and continue on their way. But it was, yeah, it was one of those moments where it wasn't clear exactly what we should do. We had kind of gotten ourselves into a situation where we knew we were harassing them but and didn't want to be. But there wasn't a great way out either. So I hope that we made the right choice.
It sure sounded like you did. From the moment I opened the book, I found myself extremely invested in you as a woman about my daughter's age, as an ornithologist who specialized in chickadees, as someone who likes to take adventures. I've done some camping all alone in national forests and things. And so I just very strongly found you an extremely compelling character and really cared about how this trip went for you. And
thank you.
But I very quickly got invested in Pat too. And through the book, I found myself increasingly invested in your parents too. They took that extraordinary trip. I was so worried about your father. How are they doing?
They're doing well. I'm actually back here in Anchorage. We've had sort of a sabbatical year and have been at our remote cabin and doing a bit of traveling. And so we just got back to Anchorage and we're pretty happy to see my parents. I have two little boys now, and so they're very excited to see their grandparents as well. Yeah, my dad is, you know, he certainly doesn't have the easiest road with dealing with Parkinson's, and He's recently had back surgery, but is recovering very well. And yeah, he's real inspiration on so many levels, including his perseverance through challenging situations, including dealing with Parkinson's disease. But I think he and I are very similar in many ways, one of them being kind of our love for being physical and taking on, you know, personal challenges. And so he's continued to do that very much in his life. And my mom is one of those people who you meet once and you'll always remember. She's incredibly positive and funky and amazing with our two little boys. And so I feel really fortunate to, yeah, still get to spend a lot of time with both of them. And so far, we're all doing okay. So
wonderful. Was writing the book fun?
It was a lot of fun a lot of the time. And then there were moments of, you know, wondering what I was doing, and certainly a lot of bashing my head against the wall. But I have a background in writing, but I hadn't ever taken on the project of trying to put together a book and get it published. And there's a whole lot to that whole process that, you know, I wasn't aware of before I started. Fortunately, I have a good community of other writers and really great support who kind of helped me along the way. But it's a long and can be a really difficult process, as anyone who's done a writing project and worked on a book knows. You know, I was fortunate to get a really wonderful agent and a really wonderful publisher, and I've had a great experience since that time. But it took a while to get to the point of feeling really positive about the whole product, I guess.
The sections of your book each have a beautiful illustration. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so Pat, one of his many talents is he's an artist. And a lot of his artistic efforts have recently been put into designing homes and cabins and more architectural aspects. But he has a background in art and drawing and sculpture, and that's what he did as an undergrad at Western Washington University. And so he was nice enough to do the illustrations part of the book. I would say that, you know, certainly I wrote the book, but Pat's been very intimately involved in it all coming together since the beginning. I mean, certainly the trip, but even the writing process. And he's been my biggest cheerleader and also the first person I go to when I want to bounce ideas off of someone. So just one more contribution of his.
I read a lot at bedtime, and I usually have no trouble putting a book down after I finish one chapter. Sometimes I have to read a second. But your book grew increasingly compelling. It was obvious from the start, spoiler alert, that you and your husband both survived the trip and are still together. But the book grew ever more exciting the further I got into it, and I finished the last third in a single night, which meant I didn't get any sleep at all.
Oh, dear.
Well, so I thought I should share that.
Thank you so much. Yeah, well, I'm sorry you had a sleepless night, but
it was so worth it. And I woke up, so your book, it just was wonderful from start to finish. And you just managed to weave in so many different golden kinds of threads of different kinds of writing all into one seamless work.
Well, thank you so much. I think one thing that was really interesting for me along the sort of journey of writing the book is how it evolved over time. So it started out as more of a journalistic kind of, this is what happened, you know, this is what I saw, and had a fair bit of science in it, but probably, you know, I'd been pretty well trained as a scientist and had taken a fair amount of time away from creative writing. So I almost had to untrain myself and sort of allow the more creative voice to find its way back into my writing. And then I think I pulled back a little bit from the science and tried to write more of the personal story. And then fortunately, the birds found their way back into the story, which I realized was such an important part of my experience as well. So yeah, it's come a long ways, I guess, in terms of you know, where I started and then what the final book looks like. And I've been really fortunate to have some amazing readers and editors along the way to help me see the big picture, which can be hard to do when you're so, you know, deep into the writing process.
Well, it all worked out magnificently.
Well, thank you so much.
I want to pull away from the book just for a bit because of my deep love for chickadees. In the winter of 2013-14, I had a chickadee with an overgrown, deformed bill coming to my feeder in Duluth, and he, and I know it was a he now, but I didn't at the time, could pull mealworms out of my hand and manipulate them much more easily than he could sunflower seeds, so he was coming to my window constantly all winter. We've had, like, I know of 4 cases total in Minnesota, but this has been a huge problem in Alaska, and that's what you did your work on. So I would like to hear about the work you've done.
Sure. So, yeah, I was first drawn to this problem in 2005. I was working on a different project, and the person I was working for at the time, she was studying this recent sort of outbreak of chickadees, largely black catfish chickadees with severely overgrown beaks. And I was really fascinated by it for a lot of reasons. For one, it's just a really compelling sight, as you describe. You know, you see these amazing, hardy little birds that have so much, you know, on their plates already in terms of surviving these really cold temperatures and finding their food caches over the winter and just being these spunky, wonderful birds that we all love to see at our feeders and, you know, out in the woods. And to see one with a severely overgrown beak, you know, it was really kind of personally striking. And then I think from a scientific perspective, it was also really intriguing because at that point, we had no idea what was causing it. And so then I began a graduate project to learn more about the beak deformities. And I thought that I would be doing more work on toxicology. So I had figured that we would want to be understanding possible links between environmental contaminants and the beaks. And quickly realized that, you know, the questions that we still needed to answer were much, much more basic than that. We didn't know how, you know, a bird's beak grew. We didn't know what the inside of, from a cellular perspective, what the inside of a beak looked like. We weren't sure if there was a, you know, a food or feeder component to the development of the deformity. So there was a lot of very basic science questions that needed to be answered first. And that's kind of how I ended up spending so much time in the lab, which wasn't my original intention. And I think we learned a lot, and then I needed a break from the lab. And that was part of what inspired the time on the trip.
The individual I was tracking coming to my window, the tip of his bill broke off in the spring, and I could recognize him by that squared off tip until it sort of wore away. But meanwhile, I discovered that he also had a deformed foot that I hadn't even been paying attention to because I was so focused on the bill. He was missing his three front toes on one foot. And when I looked through my photos of the one with the deformed bill, if I could see that foot, I could see that it was missing the toes. And he didn't attract a mate that year, but the following year he did, and they brought off at least 5 healthy fledglings. So
wow.
So that was really heartening.
They are amazing. Some of the adaptations that we've seen them, you know, come up with to deal with the deformity, you know, are really fascinating scientifically, but also just as an observer to see that in some cases we would observe one individual passing food off to another. Because as you mentioned, it's very difficult for the birds with the deformed beaks to be able to manage food normally. And so feeding nestlings can be really difficult. And so there are some cases observed where, you know, a bird with a deformed beak would pass off to his or her partner, and then the one with the normal beak could feed the nestlings. And a lot of really, you know, amazing strategies to deal with a pretty major handicap or disability with the overgrown beaks. And it's interesting that you mentioned that the tip of the beak breaking off, and that was something I saw with the captive work I did, that was actually a mechanism that they seemed to allow them to continue normal function for much longer. So sometimes you'll see that birds with the deformed beaks, they do a lot of beak wiping, which, you know, normal birds will do anyway. But I suspect that that might be a bit of a response to having this, you know, very unwieldy appendage
yeah.
kind of attached to their beak. And so if they can get that tip to break off, then they tend to buy themselves a bit more time in terms of being able to eat more normally and preen and do all those things that they need to do with their beak.
Are the birds with the deformity being reported at the same level still that they were when you started the project?
It seems to be fairly steady within South Central Alaska. But there have been increases in certain regions. So in interior Alaska, it was about 5 or 8 years later that the larger number of black-capped chickadees with deformed beaks started to pop up. And at first it was just a smattering, and then it increased quite a bit. You know, we don't have a good handle for a lot of regions exactly what the prevalence is in a population. Many places there's nobody doing chickadee research, or they're remote areas where, you know, there just aren't people there to observe them. And there's certainly the potential, as there's more awareness about this problem, that you get an increase in reports or sightings because people are looking for it. But some of the cases, like the one you described, they're severe enough, and the black-capped chickadees are popular enough backyard feeder birds that, you know, if there are severely deformed beaks, people tend to notice them and want to tell somebody about it because it is such an unusual sighting. So I don't think it's purely an effective kind of observer bias where people are looking, so that now they're seeing them. There's also been a number of other species affected by something that looks very similar. So red-tailed hawks in the Pacific Northwest have been showing up with deformed beaks over a similar time frame, and we're trying to determine if that may be, you know, the same disease or at least the same cause. And a number of other species in North America, and then I mentioned there was a cluster in the UK of tit and other species closely related to chickadees that have very similar looking deformities. And then more recently in South America, Argentina and Chile, we've had a growing number of reports and a couple of papers published in the scientific literature recently suggesting that some species might be showing a very similar condition. And again, we don't know if they're linked or not, but that's kind of our next step, is trying to understand the global scope of this disease.
Well, that's fascinating. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to talk with me about your wonderful book and about chickadees.
Well, thank you so much. And thanks for all that you do to kind of spread awareness and help us all enjoy birds that much more. And yeah, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.